We're thrilled to welcome Ross Newhouse to the podcast, a multifaceted artist whose talent spans songwriting, performing, and curating unforgettable live music experiences. As a booker for So Far in New York City, Ross plays a pivotal role in orchestrating the organization's signature intimate concerts, bringing together artists and audiences in a unique setting across the city. Beyond his work behind the scenes, Ross is an accomplished musician in his own right, showcasing his prowess as a lyricist and storyteller. In today's episode, we'll delve into Ross's journey as a musician and his current endeavors with So Far and discuss the evolving landscape of live music in today's world. Ross, welcome to the podcast. We're excited to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can you tell us kind of how So Far first emerged, how it came to be?
Sure. Yeah, so Far started in London. Our founder, Rafe Offer, invited folks to his flat, as they say, to have an intimate show. I think he was really fed up with the concert scene of going to shows, watching the shows through people's cell phones, expensive drinks, people chatting through the shows, things like that. And he wanted to kind of turn that on its head a little bit. I don't think he ever really envisioned it becoming what it is today, but he had his first show in 2009, and then it just kind of snowballed from there, where people from that flat went on to host their own shows, and it expanded through London. It expanded into different cities in Europe, and then eventually to New York City and all over the US as well. And now we're in around 400 different cities around the world. There's a So Far show practically every night, and we do about 8 to 10 of them a week here in New York City. So the evolution has been about 10-15 years of intimate live music. Yeah.
Wow. So how do you go about seeking your guests and booking your guests?
Sure. Yeah. So we have an application pool that we review. Me and it's not just myself, it's a team of us that go in and we take a listen to the applications. And we also get referrals from labels, management companies, booking agencies, things like that. And we work with artists at all different scales. So basically, you just have to be really, really great live and bring something. This is a live music space. And I think there's been a lot of discourse around AI, around, you know, Melodyne, auto-tuning, things like that. And like, I think people are really wanting that live music, that live music feel, and that, like, you know, real human-to-human connection. So we ask that, like, you come with the best live footage that you'd have when you apply to these shows and stuff like that. So we don't really care about the size, which I think is the coolest thing. We have had artists, like, this is their first time releasing music. They don't have music out yet, but they're bringing a really unique and wonderful perspective and performance to the show, and they just start to grow within So Far. And that's kind of the coolest part of my job, is that, like, finding a person who is just starting, maybe just moved to New York, just graduated from music school, something like that. And I'm just like, we're getting them at ground zero here, because this is going to be a big name and someone that everyone knows someday. Yeah.
Now, I assume you don't want to take just anybody. So how do you sift through that and say who's ready or worthy of starting out here and kind of picking them out from the pack rather than just giving anybody a stage?
Sure. So we are really selective in the application process. It's tough. It's tough to get a So Far gig, and there's limited shows. And the biggest part of So Far is that as an artist, you're arriving to an audience that's pre-filled for you. You don't really have to do any of the marketing yourselves. You can if you'd like, but me as an artist, that was the best part, was showing up and having there be like 60 attentive audience members that I didn't need to know, and they weren't friends of mine and anything like that, just exposed to my music. It is a really amazing form. And yeah, we go through with a fine tooth comb. We've rejected people who have, you know, accolades and things because we think that they're a better studio musician, or we want to give the opportunity to someone with a little bit more of a different approach to the instruments and to songwriting than we're used to. So yeah, I mean, it's hard because you don't want to say no to people and you want everyone to have the shot, but you also realize that guests are paying for this experience, and they want the top talent, especially in New York City, where you can see someone who is leagues above you busking on the subway station. Like, there's just talent dripping from every crack in the city.
So, that's true.
Yeah. So anyway, that's about how we do it. And yeah, there's times where we'll reject an application and they'll come back after the window opens back up for them and apply with something really great. And we'll take a second look and say, you've grown into this and I think we're ready now. Or we look at someone and we say, I think this person's going to be great in a year. Maybe they just graduated high school or just graduated college. They're young. They just started. And like, let's see them cut their teeth at open mics and stuff like that, and come back to us when they have a little bit more experience, and they do, and then they start their journey with us.
Who are some of the bigger artists that you've worked with? And talk about what it's like having them in such intimate settings.
We just did a show with The Head and the Heart last week, which was really, really special for me because I had seen them at Bonnaroo in 2012. And I remember I was playing, there's a bad cover on Facebook somewhere of me in high school, speaking of artistic growth, of doing one of their songs. So it was really, really special for me to meet them and to work with their team. And they're absolutely lovely. But I think there's a pushback from the traditional venues and everything like that. And there's these moments. We saw Lorde do a pop-up concert in Washington Square Park, and Mumford & Sons popped up and did a show at Irish Bar on the East Village. I'm blanking on the name completely. But they're kind of creating these moments where you're going back to just fan to fan, and you're creating these like, or fan to artist, and you're creating these really like special times that fans will never really forget, that I think with the inflated cost of ticket prices these days, you know, it's like $300 to go that nosebleeds at Beyonce, if you're lucky. It's become really hard for people to go see shows. So to see The Head and the Heart, and they actually did it for free in Greenpoint, free for fans, in front of like a crowd of 200 or 300 people, was really special. It was really special for them too, because the church sounded great that we put them in. They got to meet fans and kind of exist at a level that makes them feel more like they were just starting out, and kind of returns them to the place of the music first and less about the name and the tour and the posters and the signings and all this stuff, and get back to like telling stories about the songs in front of a group of people who really, really love the music. That's been a more special part. Yeah.
And for our loyal listeners, if you remember the podcast with Brian Calhoun of Rockbridge Guitar, The Head and the Heart play Rockbridge.
Play some beautiful instruments. They're really, really great. And they're a special band, and they sounded unbelievable. I'm really excited for that live video to come out on our channel in the next coming weeks. Yeah.
What do you find more challenging, finding the artists or finding the venues, or matching the artists with the venues to achieve the sound that everybody wants to get?
That's a great question. Venues are a challenge because we're in New York City, and real estate and space is at a premium. We're also popping up in non-traditional venues, and with that comes challenges. You know, not everything sounds as amazing as a church does. So finding the place that mixes like a surprise and delight for fans, works acoustically, has the nights of the week available, wants to host live music in general. I mean, that's just like in the building habit. Is there a hotel that, you know, there's rooms around the corner and the guests don't really like it when there's a band playing outside at 9 o'clock? That's a bigger challenge than it is finding artists. There are, as I said, I feel just so blessed to be doing this job in New York City, where there's just talent everywhere. So it's been a wonderful experience to meet people from genres outside of my own, and go see just like incredible jazz vocalists, incredible R&B singers, rappers, Sufi singers, things like that. It's really amazing that there's such a diverse level of talent. Also, you can be amazing as a singer-songwriter, and like I mentioned, we had a Sufi singer come and play, and he put like everyone in this trance. It was the most beautiful singing, but that's not something you would get everywhere in every city. The artist side is the really exciting part, and the venues is the little bit more challenging. And I'd say that pairing artists and venues is always a fun one too. But when you get it right and you have that night where like you just put the really fun funk band on a rooftop, you catch lightning in a bottle. It's awesome.
You had said that it's more challenging to find the venues. And I imagine that there's a degree of unpredictability that comes with a new venue. Even just right now, Eric and I are using a new software for recording, and there are so many kinks that we're working out with it just to get it right. What happens in a newer venue when something goes wrong and there's no predictability to it? How do you figure that out in the moment?
Well, the really great thing is that we have these two crew leads, Ariel and Lexi, who go to all the shows. I think between the two of them, they've probably worked over 600, 700 shows together. Ariel's been with the company a while, so is Lexi, doing sound and everything. And they're just experts at controlling environments, whether that be like, you know, someone who's not supposed to be there wandering in and they're like, hey, this is a ticketed concert, you know, or just like dealing with people and dealing with expectations. It really is a hospitality role. So they take the role of like event planner, of hostess, of, you know, person that is going to be the control factor of the evening. And they do a really, really great job. And there are a lot of variables. There's weather is one of the biggest ones. And we always make sure that there's like an indoor contingency for an outdoor show. We had a lot planned for this week and it has been raining the entire week. So we've got to just like, we look at the weather on the weeks where we know there's going to be some great outdoor shows. We're supposed to be out on Pier 16 at this place called Cobblefish. And we're so excited to finally get out there, but they didn't have an indoor, so we'll cancel and probably move to our headquarters location in Chinatown. Things like that, where there's just like little processes that we go through to make sure that the fan experience is always there, even when there's so many variables outside of like regular venues control. Also, I'll give a shout out to Brett, our sound engineer. He has a really challenging job. He shows up to places that are, you know, big and boomy, or they're small and intimate, or there's like, you know, things going on outside that like construction we didn't plan for. And he seems to mix around all those things and always leave us with a really great sounding evening.
If you're working with, let's say, some less experienced artists, they may not either know what they need in terms of sound in the room or sounds in their monitors. How does your team manage that? How do they navigate the different wants and needs and expectations of the artists to achieve the sound that they're seeking?
I think that is, there's a bit of a therapist role within being a sound engineer also. You know, it's not just being the engineer. You have to shake the nerves that the artist is feeling. Sometimes the artist is hearing things that aren't even there because they're nervous. They're about to get on stage in front of a bunch of people who they don't know and that they want to impress and hopefully remember them and stuff like that. So Brett's a very calming person. The rest of our team, Megan and everyone else is brings that kind of energy, and that's the energy we kind of look for. A lot of the artists are experienced enough where it's not very foreign to them. We would actually say that there's more hiccups with very experienced artists because they have everything they want dialed down to a T. And that might be, you know, we do these stripped down shows and sometimes they're like, okay, usually I have my four background singers and my in-ear monitors and my this and that, and we do this and track. And it's like, okay, well, we're doing more of like a strip back acoustic set tonight. So kind of bring that configuration into mind when we're doing a so far show. So it's kind of almost about scaling back sometimes with these artists than it is about making sure that the level of experience is there. And at the very least, like, you know, we have monitors and a great sound system and all this stuff. So you can always hear yourself and you can always give the performance that you're trying to give with the crew that we bring. Yeah.
It's interesting. It sounds almost the polar opposite. So we've had some artists who play giant festivals, 40, 50,000 people, and talk about the idea of it being a throw and go set where you're not having a sound check, you're just getting up on stage and playing, and you're relying on the professionalism of your team and that they just know how to do what they do. And similar, it sounds like the way your shows are oriented is that the performer needs to trust that your sound people know how to work with these venues in this stripped down sort of environment and just, hey, let it happen. We got you.
There's trust all around this company in these shows. You know, there's trust from the consumer where you are coming into a show sight unseen. You don't know who the artists are going to be. You don't know who the venues are going to be. So you trust us to pick great artists and great venues. You have the artists that are trusting us that there's going to be a crowd there of people that are hungry to listen to music and quiet and respectful in listening to that music, and trust that the sound engineer is going to do a great job and present the best product to the audience that they can do. So yeah, it's just, it's left and right, but hopefully that trust stays. And we've done such a great job over the past 10 or so years in building that trust. And I think that's why artists are really, really thankful when they take the stage with us. And they're really excited to continue to take the stage once they do get on for the first time.
As you said earlier, New York is bursting with musical talent all over the place. Does SoFar adapt its approach in different cities or different regions to reflect the local music scenes elsewhere, wherever you else are based?
Yeah, so we used to have a model where we were booking more regionally, where the team in New York was booking artists in Philly and DC, all up the East Coast, and there was a central team and a team out West. That's just for the United States, I'll speak specifically. But now those cities are mostly, if not all, operated locally. So I manage only New York City, Candace manages only Philadelphia, and so on and so forth. what we're doing now is we're really hyper-local in each city, and we don't have as many broader metrics to hit or things that we're trying to do as a global company that affect like the local level, if that makes sense. Like there's more autonomy, I should say, with what you can do on the ground, if that makes sense for what your city does and what your city, what the feedback and what the city like desires and everything like that. That can be about show frequency. That can be about the kind of artists that you pick. So like in Miami, there might be a lot more Latin and Cuban music. In Montreal, there might be more French Canadian and French speaking music than there would at a regular So Far New York show. If I book, you know, certain populations here, they might not be reflected as much. You know, you want to reflect the population of the city, and you want to reflect the diversity and the like excellence of the city in that way. In New York, there's no shortage of like every genre, but maybe there's a little bit less like, I don't know, hip hop in like Quebec than there is hip hop in New York or Atlanta. And there might be fewer singer songwriters in Atlanta than there are in LA or Nashville, the singer songwriter capital. Finding those things and kind of catering to your strengths is what I think our strengths are as a company, in that you'll never really get the same experience in two different cities, whether that be the venues. Obviously the venues, but the hosts, the way they go through the night, you'll always get those three artists and the quality of those artists, but those artists might be vastly different and bring something completely new to the table. And that's why I think every night is so new and exciting. It's like jazz in a concert, you know, you never know.
Will you ever have artists that are kind of doing a run from city to city or within the city within your venues?
Sure. Yeah. We like to do it sometimes with more established artists, just because now with the localization and the fact that we're all kind of doing what's best for our city and the artists that are in our city. I have like 400 artists on my roster right now in New York that I think are fantastic, maybe more like 300. And that always grows because we're going into the application pool weekly and finding 1, 2, 3 amazing people to add onto the list. So I try to prioritize them first because there are limited slots. Also, just it used to be a little bit easier with the regional teams, and they would be able to kind of put you on a few slots on the East Coast or something like that. But touring is very beneficial, and when we can pull it off, it is really cool for the artist side of things. And I think the fans appreciate when there's someone new in town that they got to see. Artists, though, it's great because, you know, you're going to a different city and you're playing in front of a crowd that you didn't, again, have to market to or invite specifically. Our favorite thing to do is when a band has a night off in a city. So they're coming to play. For example, this weekend, Hunter Metz is opening up for James Bay. He has the night off after the James Bay concert, and he's going to come play with us on Saturday night on the 20th, if they're 26th. Let me check my calendar. So 24th, neither one of those first ones. That's really, really special because you get to see someone who just played in front of like 2,000 people now play in front of 90. And that's a really, really unique thing, I think. So far does really
must be hard. That must be so fascinating for them to adapt to going from a show from thousands to a much more intimate setting.
Some say they're a lot more nervous.
Really?
You know? Yeah, because I guess when you're on the, let's say, the Brooklyn Paramount and the lights are on your eye, you can't see a single person. You're up there, you've got your monitors in your ears, you can hear your band, you can hear the click track, all stuff like that. But when you're at, you know, So Far HQ or a rooftop venue and everyone's right in front of you and they're sitting down next to you and everything like that, there's a lot more push and pull with the audience that you don't usually get when you're standing on stage in front of security, you know? So it leaves you like, it's a lot more vulnerable feeling. Not that we would ever need security, but it's like, you know, you're right there with fans and you're going to speak with them after the show and everything like that. And some musicians are introverts, and it's just a lot different, but it's very, very special.
Do you feel like So Far has become or evolved into a community of some sort, whether it's between artists that have all performed there or audience members that come back continuously? Do you feel like it's a loyal group amongst each other that's become this community?
Definitely. Yeah, I think community is it's a bit of a buzzword now. And I think that's a post-COVID thing where we like spent so long inside without it that people want to be around each other. So I would say the community that we have, first off, speaking of my own personal experience, like being in this role is such a wonderful experience because I've gotten to meet so many artists and so many really, really talented artists, and ones that I would now call close friends and collaborators. And that is the same way with a lot of the artists in the Stofar network, in the Stofar world. They end up collaborating with each other. Producers, session guitar players for one act get picked up by another act. I'll shout out a guy named Noah Lexi. He plays for so many bands. I keep coming to Stofar shows and he's just there. And I'm like, how do you remember all these songs? So he's the hired gun. And it's something that happens where artists will move here from a different state and they'll say, I really need a guitar player or else I'll have to do this or I can't really play. And I'll recommend them so far guitarists or so far pianists or whatever they need in the world. And even our audio engineer, Brett, who I've mentioned before, has hopped on with an artist named Aji, who he plays guitar for him now. So there's just like this amazing collaboration that goes on. And then audience members, yeah, the coolest thing that I think happens is, like we like to say, we use Stofar as a passport. Because we are in so many cities, if you don't really know what to do when you're in Paris, or you don't know what to do, you have a night in London where you want to catch live music, you can go see a Stofar show and there's going to be a bunch of people that are usually from the area that are there. And one thing that Rafe, our founder, does so well is always kind of finds the person who's new in town in the audience. And that happened a show I was playing a couple months ago in Williamsburg. There was a guy named Gary there, fresh from Ireland, had just come to the show by himself. And it just moved to the city and Rafe shouted him out on stage and said, there's a new friend in town. And a lot of people were introducing themselves and honestly welcoming him to the city and everything like that. So it's a nice way to go and meet local artists, see local talent, and kind of get a pulse of the city while you're in a new place as well. That's why we call it a global community, is because you can really find a little piece of local music and local culture wherever you end up.
And what can artists expect from Stofar in terms of, once they're selected, you choose them, you want to do a show together and collaborate, what can they expect that process to look like? And what should they expect from the organization?
So there's a lot of benefits of being a Stofar artist. Obviously, the shows are first and foremost, where you get booked for a show. There is a little bit of a wait time after you get selected, especially if you play more of like a niche music genre where we need to kind of find you the right place and the right time to play. But once you play, we kind of look at the performance. We look at like what the crew thought, what the audience thought, and we decide like how we're going to rebook you, the frequency we're going to rebook. Right now, even our best artists are playing at max like two times a month, maybe three if there's a cancellation, just because of the amount of artists and the amount of slots that we have available. But then from there, there's just a ton of opportunities with our commercial partnership and our brand partnership team for higher paying events when it comes to like partnerships with our Visa partnership or our Virgin Hotels partnership. Do private shows where companies come to us and they want to do shows at their offices or retreats or something like that. DEI initiatives, parties, fests, celebrations, things like that. And there's a little bit of a bigger budget where we can offer artists a lot more to go play. We have our YouTube channel. So at times we'll choose to film a show and there's, you know, over a million subscribers on the YouTube channel. We have our Instagram platform as well. And then you just meet people and you connect and you kind of like become a part of this like little ecosystem in New York specifically for me. But yeah, there's a lot of like, there's a lot of social, there's a lot of like, there can be financial, there's a lot of like just exposure and meeting new fans. I mean, I think that's the one that people keep coming back to me and is the biggest part, is that they'll see someone who saw them at a Stofar show at a show that they're playing at the Mercury Lounge or Bowery Ballroom a few weeks from there because the person was a big fan. I have tons of people who have followed me from the Stofar shows, and it's just a way to, like, when people follow you from a reel that you made or like a video that you're doing, like, you don't know how much they're actually attached to you. But when you get a follower that you've actually met in real life, it doesn't feel like someone who just clicked follow because they liked your content or whatever. You know, it felt like someone that you made a genuine connection, and that might be someone who invests in your music and likes your art form that much that they'd be willing to come see you again and pay their harder money to see that. So I think that's what Stofar does so well, is they are the kind of first point for independent artists to get real life connections in front of new people.
You being a musician, do you ever perform as part of Stofar?
Yes, it is. And I, when I took the role, I was like, I'm going to be normal about this. I'm not going to pitch myself to everything. I'm going to follow the same rules as all the other artists and hold myself to actually a higher quality, because it then made me nervous that I'm the person booking and the person playing. So I wanted to be as good as everyone that I was booking, or else I'd start taking myself off of the shows. But yeah, I started playing with SoFar in 2021. I played a bunch of shows. They were fantastic. My music's evolved since I began, but at the time was making very indie folk storyteller music. And I was finding, similar to Rafe's story, that I was going to play bars and my friends were showing up and they were chatting with each other because they haven't seen each other. And no one was really listening to the music. And the first SoFar I played was in front of 60 people. It was at Arlo Nomad in the Nomad part of Manhattan, and dead silent crowd. Amazingly attentive. There's another artist named Majori who had this unfathomable voice. I got to meet her. I got to just like connect with the team and everything like that. And I was hooked. And it was so special and unique for me to be able to play in front of new people who were there to listen to music that they didn't know and that they were interested in. It's like a real life Discover Weekly playlist, you know, on Spotify. It's like you're showing up and we're feeding you three people who we think are going to be amazing. So anyway, I then went on to be a sound engineer, and then I went on to be an MC at the same time for SoFar. So I did audio, I did the crew side of things, and then I got my first part-time role with them about 2 years ago. And then through just a series of different changes and promotion, things like that, I found my way into this booker role now, which is a really like the center of a Venn diagram of like, I worked with the venues, I worked on the crew, worked on the audio team.
You know,
am
the
an
ins
artist,
and outs.
So I have the ins and outs pretty well. Yeah. But to answer your question, yes, I love to play them. I wish I played them a little bit more. I think I'm actually less frequent than I was before I booked, but I've been really working really hard on an album. So the live thing is going to be kind of the next step again.
Can you tell us about being a musician? Can you tell us about your songwriting process, kind of how you start an idea? How do you tend to make its way towards the final piece?
Yeah, a lot of the times it comes from like what I call a thesis statement, or like a single phrase or something like that, where I think of something evocative. I wish I had a little bit more control over when it hits me, but sometimes I'll just be walking around and I'll think of a line. A lot of my music, like the first line of the song, is, like I mentioned, the thesis statement and a way to kind of kick off the idea or the point of the music. I, very differently from a lot of artists I know, usually start with lyrics and not the melody. Sometimes I'll write most of the song on my notes app before I even touch an instrument, and then I try to figure it out from there. But there's also times where I do the inverse, where I find some chords I really like and I just start mumbling words, and I find that a lot of stuff happens improvisationally with me finding the right lyrics or finding what the concept of the song is going to be. But I rarely start like melody first, like a lot of songwriters that I really admire do. But yeah, that's kind of the process. And I've written a lot over the years with an amazing person named Mario Spinetti, who is my voice coach and a mentor of mine. I've just kind of recently started opening up myself to collaborating on my own music. I was very protective of my own lyrics and everything like that, even though I songwrite for a lot of people. And an artist who I met at a SoFar show, Elise Peterson, helped me write the last song on this forthcoming album. And she's been a phenomenal collaborator, and she'll be featured on this song too. And an artist named Grace Gardner is going to be on this record as well, and Lucy Clearwater. So I actually have some really great collaborators. I love collaboration, which is why I think SoFar has been so fun, is because I get to just meet so many people and kind of see where we can fit in together, or if we can just commiserate at a bar or something like that if we don't have any crossover musically.
The guitar player in me is curious what instruments you play.
Yeah, I just got a Fender Telecaster. I have a Gibson Les Paul, and then my main one is a Martin 00015 that I've had since that was my high school graduation present, and I'm in my early 30s now. So that's the one guitar that's never gone anywhere. That's the one, if you look at a picture of me playing live, it's 95% sure that I'll be playing that one. It's just like, it's like an extension of me at this point. So it's what I've written all my music on. And even though I'm going in a direction where some of these songs don't have guitar, or they might be electric or synth driven or something like that, most of them, if not all of them, started on that Martin guitar, me in a room somewhere, jotting down chords and trying to think of something cool to say.
Do you feel like your musical style or your songwriting, has that changed over time?
Definitely. Yeah. It's gotten a lot. I'd say the first records I put out, not under my Ross Newhouse project, but my like previous work and the things I was first making just like weren't very good. Like I had to figure out how to write a song, and I got advice from an artist named Adam Melcher, who is phenomenal. Also,
he also plays Rockbridge.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's awesome. Maybe there's something there. I need to reach out to them. But yeah, he's phenomenal. And he was like, just tell a story and be clever and speak from the heart. And I think previously I was trying to write really cool, evocative phrases that didn't really mean that much. And then I wrote a song called Funniest Thing that's all about like the moments in a relationship where you kind of mess with each other, but you love each other so much. It's that kind of not push and pull, but that just like poking at each other that people that have been in a relationship for a long time tend to do. I was inspired by my parents, but it was like one of the first songs where I was like, this is actually like, this is the kind of music that I want to be writing. And I still write that kind of music. And I think I've gotten a little bit more vulnerable with the stories that I tell and with the reflection of myself, but I don't write very like almost like the diary entry, the very like matter of fact kind of folk that I tend to hear today. I still like to wrap it in the craft of songwriting, the veil of metaphor and writing devices and things like that, and try to make it smart, clever, make you think a little bit, but not try to like teach you something. And then production wise, it's gone from pretty like acoustic guitar driven folk to indie rock, indie electronic, bedroom pop. I've been working with a producer from a band called Cool Company. His name's Cole Lumpkin, and he studied sound design, and he's just got this like unbelievable way that he approaches music. It's like a savant piano player. Love the guy. And he's just kind of has changed how I approach production. And then lastly, I work with an artist named Kinship, who I've been a massive fan of like the last 10 years. And I shot him a DM and he was really open to working together. And I think I've got to the point in my songwriting where I thought I could give someone I idolize and really love a song of mine and it would work out. And he did a great job too. And that's more in like the electronic sphere also, which has always been a big inspiration of mine. So I'm glad it's starting to find its way back to the music
that
I made.
That's awesome. We often ask on the podcast if our guest has had a time where they've been a part of somebody else's story, where maybe they've influenced some fan or somebody that they've worked with, somebody that they barely know. So have you ever found a time either in your professional work as a musician or with So Far where you found that you've been a part of somebody's story that you've influenced somebody around you?
That's a great question. I mean, I want to say that with the things that we do at So Far and the things that I'm able to do when I can accept a new artist and bring them into this world is probably doing more than I think. There's countless artists that I've brought on that have gone to play a bunch of shows, that are collabing with each other, that are playing bigger shows and starting to really find their footing in New York, might not have had the same experience without So Far. So on a broader scale, I think like a lot of the artists that I bring on and that are successful in doing these shows and everything like that, I probably had a hand in some small way. Obviously, I think their talent would have spoken for themselves at some point, but I get to move them along, at least in this capacity, which I think is one of the coolest parts of the job. Yeah, I'm not sure about anyone like the influence of, I know my songs have been very comforting to some people in times of need, just because of the realness and the bluntness that I have in the songs and the music. And yeah, I've been talking to a friend of mine. He's a lot younger and I drove his family. It's a little bit of a backtrack, but my dad has a driving business. And I filled in for him one time when he was sick. And I took this family and their son, I think is in like late middle school, maybe early high school now, and is really interested in music. And I noticed one day that I had a bio on Genius that I hadn't written, and he had written it. And I was like so enthralled because I was like, oh, this is so cool. Because when I was his age, I had people who were older musicians that would reach out to me. There was a guy from a band called The Mimicking Birds that like talked to me after a show, or this guy, Chris Rite, was a senior when I was a freshman in our guitar club. And he kind of encouraged me to sing. And it was like, you're just looking at these like bigger people and that are more established. And I was just chatting with him again the other night because he hit me up after a long time asking how like the album's been going. And I like hope he continues to create music and hope I can find more of a mentorship role with younger musicians too. I think that would be a really, really special way to keep contributing and maybe like teach music someday and something like that. Yeah. So I'm not sure right now who specifically. I think a lot of people in the SOPAR world, but my hope is to mentor more and kind of like keep building out these smaller relationships.
You'll come back on the podcast and we'll ask you the same question again.
I would love that. I would love that. Yeah.
So for my last question, the audiologist in me is curious about how you and the SOPAR team thinks about hearing health and ear protection, if it's a part of what you consider. Now, if you're talking about acoustic shows in small venues, we're probably not talking about really loud levels like you're getting in arena shows, but is that something that you all are thinking about?
Personally, in the last like few years, my dad was unfortunately diagnosed with tinnitus, and I used to play in a rock band in a basement in high school, and we would come out and our ears would be ringing and we'd be like, yeah, that was an awesome rehearsal. 10 years later, I'm like, uh-oh.
So now the appropriate reaction.
Exactly. Now I have earplugs on my keychain that I put in at practically every show that I go to. I'm not just saying that to impress you guys, but it has been a huge help. And honestly, God, we used to love to go to the front of the shows and stand right by the speakers and everything. So I'm hoping everything works out for the best. But it is our job and our livelihoods. And so I see a lot of musicians doing that and wearing earplugs at shows, but I don't see a lot of non-musicians doing it. And I want that to change because I don't think people realize how much louder concerts have gotten and the impact of even just being at one of these shows, what it can have on your hearing. At SOPAR, I mean, I obviously do things like I don't book drums in a venue that's like a living room, you know, something like that. Like the drums are like for the outdoor shows, they're for bigger audiences, things like that. Our engineers do a really great job of keeping the volume at an appropriate level. And I think the music of SOPAR lends itself to a lighter ear anyway with just the genres and the music that we book in the spaces that we book. So yeah, we do a lot of acoustic shows where the artists are just projecting or they're playing the room, turning and facing the different audience members. We do a lot of just like strip back. Like if you have drums, you might bring a three piece and not a cymbal, a hi-hat, a snare and a kick drum. And it might be, you know, a smaller jazz kit. It might be a cajon instead of like a full kit. So I think it is like a step down from a traditional concert in terms of need for hearing protection and things like that. I'd love to get you like a decibel reading at one of the shows and tell you what we're working with.
There are apps, apps do that.
Yeah, I used to do it at I worked at the Django. I did front of house, and that's when I first like started wearing earplugs. So I was like, oh, this is actually way louder than I even thought it was. And I'm sitting there for 6-7 hours. And, you know, if I start not being able to pick up frequencies and a few years and I can't mix records and I'll be missing things about my favorite songs and such. So it's very, very important. And I'm glad that SOPAR isn't. Yeah, there's very few metal acts and things that might hurt. But yeah, I think it can be more of a concern and maybe something that we should be reaching out to maybe some sponsors and see if there's any like collaboration with earplug groups and things like that to get the word out a little bit more about hearing protection at some of the bigger venues and the louder show.
You can never advertise too much to protect your hearing. Well, Ross, it's been really awesome having you on today. And something you had said earlier is you find that the artists that are with you as SOPAR would have found their talent would have showcased themselves at some point in time, but you and your role help them get to perform a little bit sooner than they may have otherwise have. And I remember Simon Cowell being a judge on American Idol and saying that these people might find their pathway to fame at some point, but American Idol is a way to facilitate that. It's your gateway to fame. And so your role has a lot of importance in helping facilitate that fame for them or in even just the start of their career. So what you do is really awesome. And we want to see a SOPAR show now.
Thank you so much. Yeah, please let me know. I like to think of myself as a Simon Cowell. You know, that's how I go. No, I'm just kidding. But that's a great way to put it. And that's something I'll think about going forward because it's a really special and a really unique role for me to be in where I get to meet these artists and I get to believe in artists and vouch for people and make music. And that's at the end of the day, my favorite thing to do and a lot of my peers' favorite thing to do. So yeah, thank you so much for having me on. And please let me know when you would like to come see a show and we'd love to have you.
Absolutely. And before you go, why don't you let everybody know where they can connect with you and your music and with SOPAR?
Absolutely. I'm Ross Newhouse on Spotify, TikTok, RossNewhouse. And then Ross__Newhouse on Instagram. And then so far sounds is sofarsounds.com. Yeah. So far is it's a really, really special place. And I hope you get a chance to come see a show.
And when's your album coming out?
The album should be out in the, I'm going to start dropping singles in the fall. And then hopefully early next year will be the album. I'm sending everything off to Mick by this weekend. Cross your fingers. Yeah.
Awesome. Awesome.
We'll see. That's the deadline I have in my calendar, so I'm sticking to it.
Well, thank you so much coming on. We will for sure link to everything in our bio, and we'll stay
Appreciate
tuned
that.
When your music comes out.
Thank you so much. I hope you have a great rest of your day.
You as well. Thanks a lot, Ross.